entries, even though she's lived in the thick of the Los Angeles commercial movie world. Where she is pragmatic, Michael Schamburg, the film producer to whom she was long married, is fond of abstractions. Where she is always energized, he is somewhat aloof. Where she is sparkling and quick, he is meditative and intellectual. They are both take-charge people. As the deaf activist Jackie Roth said, Megan looked at the world and didn't like a lot of what she saw, so she took it in her hands and fixed it. When their son Jacob, born in 1979, was 8 months old, Megan began to suspect that he was deaf. The pediatrician said he had blocked eustachian tubes. Megan started banging pots and pans that night, but Jacob did not respond. She brought him back to the doctor, who said, "Okay, I'm going to blow up some balloons, stand behind him, and pop them with a hypodermic needle. You watch Jacob's eyes and see if they blink." Megan said, "Every time he popped the balloon, my eyes blinked." And I said, "There's got to be a more sophisticated test." At L.A. Children's Hospital, Jacob was officially diagnosed. Megan found a class on deaf education at California State University, Northridge, a university with a large deaf population. There was a panel of parents who had deaf children. These mothers would just weep. Then I would learn that their child was 30. I thought, I am not going to be unhappy about this. I wish it weren't this way, but it is, and I am going to figure it out. Megan and Michael began hunting down deaf adults. We would have them over for brunch and say, "How were you raised? What did you like? What didn't you like?" Megan recalled. She invented a primitive home sign language she used with Jacob, and she offered one of the visitors some pancakes, making a circle with her two forefingers and thumbs. The guest said, "We need to get you some lessons. You just offered me some pussy." Michael said, "We learned that successful deaf adults aren't self-pitying. We realized that we had to immerse ourselves in that culture because that was where our child was going to live. The most urgent question was what to do about giving Jacob language." When Jacob was a year old, Megan and Michael went to the John Tracy Clinic, an oral-only program founded by Spencer Tracy for his deaf son. It was considered the preeminent institution for deaf children on the West Coast. It was painted in discarded hospital green, Megan said. There were pictures of Mrs. Tracy with Richard Nixon on the wall. Michael described the place as rabidly oral. Megan had picked up some sign, and in a conference at the Tracy Clinic, she said to the instructor, "Let's just sign, since it's only you and me and Jacob." The instructor demurred, but told her that Jacob was smart and would be able to say apple in a year. Megan replied that her daughter at that age could say, "Mommy, I had a bad dream," and that she expected the same for her son. The instructor said, "Your expectations are too high." That was the end of Jacob and the Tracy Clinic. Megan was struck by how many of the deaf people she invited to brunch had no real relationships with their parents because there had never been fluent communication at home. So Megan and Michael hired a woman to teach the whole family to sign, and she moved in with them so that they could all learn as quickly as possible. "You're always knocking over glasses at dinner," Megan said. "Then it clicks in. It's linguistic and also three-dimensional and physical." When Jacob was 2.5, Megan was trying to dress him, and he was fighting her. He signed, "Scratchy and itchy," and she realized then how important it was for them to share a language. What had seemed like willfulness turned out to be perfectly rational behavior. Michael mastered fingerspelling and a pigeon sign that worked for him and for Jacob. Megan set aside her work to focus on Jacob's education. She called Gallaudet for advice. "I got the switchboard operator and said, 'I'm just looking for someone I can talk to about educating little children out here in L.A.' The operator suggested Carl Kirshner, a coda who signed fluently and had just moved to the West Coast. Megan took Jacob to Kirshner's house. "I walk in and hands are flying," Megan said. "Jacob is just wide-eyed." When Jacob saw Carl's two daughters, He made the sign for girls, and Megan said, "We were off and running." Kirshner had done parent workshops in the 70s and called them Tripod. Megan suggested setting up an advice hotline under the Tripod name. In that pre-internet time, someone would call the Tripod number and say, "My child is deaf, and I need a dentist, and I'm in Memphis." Megan and Kirshner would contact deaf people and their families in Memphis and find a dentist who knew sign. Someone else would say, "My child is deaf, and I'm afraid he can't read, and I'm in Des Moines." So they would find a deaf-friendly reading specialist in Des Moines. Around this time, Jacob, age 5, asked Megan, "Are you deaf?" And she said that she was not. He asked, "Am I deaf?" And she said that he was. Then he signed, "I wish you were deaf." Megan said, "That was such a healthy response. Not, I wish I were hearing, but I wish you were deaf." Megan went to look at deaf schools. At Riverside, students were learning how to shop for food. It was vocational training or rehab training. It wasn't school. There was signed education for deaf children in the Los Angeles public school system, but when Megan visited a classroom, she was unimpressed. The teacher was signing, but the content was horribly dull. I went back to Michael and Carl and I said, "We not only need a hotline, we need a school." They found 3 other interested families and a little preschool building. Then they found enough students to make up a class and needed a teacher. Megan wanted someone trained in both Montessori and deaf education. Only 3 people in the country qualified, and one of them became the first teacher in the Tripod School program. Megan was constantly caught in the snares of deaf politics. She was told she couldn't do all this because she wasn't deaf enough. "Well, I wasn't deaf, period," she said. Jacob was considered not deaf enough because he didn't have deaf parents. One activist said to Megan, "What you're trying to do is very noble, but the best thing would be to give your child to a deaf family and let them raise him." Megan ignored these assaults. She invented reverse mainstreaming, in which non-disabled children are put in a classroom that is focused on the needs of disabled children and learn as the disabled students learn. At Tripod, every classroom had 2 teachers, one with deaf education teaching credentials for 10 deaf and 20 hearing students. Everyone signed. Megan sought out deaf of deaf pupils because she wanted their signing level. The project required enormous amounts of money, and Michael set himself the task of securing it. He had just finished producing The Big Chill, and the cast all went on to other movies, and he persuaded them to lobby the studios to give Tripod the premieres. Michael worked on the finances and supported me, but he was building a career, and I gave my lifeblood to Tripod, Megan said. Megan wanted to place Tripod within the public school system. The Los Angeles School District was annoyed by the challenge to their deaf education program, so she moved her project to Burbank. "Then people started moving to Burbank because we were there," she said. "Burbank became a hotbed of deaf culture. Even today, you can go into a McDonald's signing and someone will start interpreting for you." People who don't use spoken language are often slow to grasp appropriate usage in written language, which is transcribed from a system that is foreign to them. The academic program that Megan put together at Tripod was unprecedented in addressing this challenge. "The biggest curse of deafness is illiteracy," Megan said. "Jacob writes better than I do." The Tripod children consistently tested at grade level or better, and the social context was unique. There's so many people signing, teachers, hearing students, siblings, that the kids are integrated on every level, Megan said. They're on the student council, they're playing sports. Jacob said, "Tripod is about a revolution. I had hearing friends, deaf friends, didn't matter. But Tripod treats the deaf students like we don't actually have special needs. And really, we do. It was helpful to me, but at some level, it's about my mother, not about me. To be fair, deaf schools at that time were all bad. Tripod was better than most, but there were not enough teachers, not enough money, not enough interpreters. I was really lucky, I know that, with this amazing family, but I still got a lot of complaints. Megan sighed when I recounted this. There were a couple of times when I had to do what was right for the program over doing what was right for my son, she said. That was tough. Michael has an elegant philosophical resolution about the tensions that led to their 1991 divorce. Megan became Tripod, he said. One, she genuinely wanted to help our child. Two, it was a calling, a worthy calling, but a consuming one. Ultimately, our relationship would have fallen apart for a number of reasons. But she was so obsessed with this thing that it began to eat into our marriage. The institution sometimes seemed more important to her than Jacob's individual education. Instead of this gigantic, groundbreaking program, we could have put together a group of three or four parents who could have afforded the tuition at a really good private school with interpreters. I wish Jacob had gotten more intellectual stimulation. But that said, I think he tends to demonize it a little bit. Jacob saw Tripod's greatest strengths as being for the hearing kids. Yet Jacob's hearing sister, Caitlin, who grew up in the program, envied the way her family's life revolved around her brother's language and culture. More fluent in sign than Megan or Michael, she came home from school in fourth grade and said, "Our class project is for each of us to teach the first grader something." Megan said, "Really? What are you going to teach?" Caitlin said, "Not sign language." Jacob went to the National Technical Institute for the Deaf at Rochester Institute of Technology, then dropped out after a year and worked at a resort in Hawaii. Then he went to Gallaudet. "I was struggling with depression, and honestly, Gallaudet's a really bad school," Jacob said. "But something important happened. Before, I'd looked down on deafness. I had a lot of self-hatred. At Gallaudet, I started meeting a lot of great deaf people who had the same interests I do. I don't really have that capital D deaf pride, but I cherish the deaf culture, and it's a place where I am empowered." For the first time, Jacob said he felt normal. Megan regretted this timetable. "He was in his mid-twenties by then. I see that as a failure on my part." I met Jacob shortly after he graduated from the School of Visual Arts at 28. He had settled in New York, and both his parents came to see him frequently. Despite speech therapy, he is unable to speak in a way that is consistently comprehensible. "I've been sorry for myself for a long time for being deaf," Jacob said. "Last year I tried to kill myself. It was not that I wanted to die, but I felt like I had no control over my life. I had a really bad fight with my girlfriend, and I took a whole bottle of Klonopin. I just wanted to give up. I was in the hospital for 3 days, unconscious. When I woke up, the first thing I saw was my mom's face, and the first thing she said to me was, 'Stop the world. I want to get off.' That's exactly how I felt." He sees a psychiatrist for medication. They sit side by side and type back and forth. The real trick, however, is finding a signing therapist. Jacob may have inherited his edge of despair from his father, who has struggled with depression through most of his adult life. "Then you mix in the deafness," Michael said. "But Jacob is tough. If the Holocaust came, he'd get so pissed off he'd figure out a way to get through it. I hope he figures a way through normal life." Megan has none of Michael's or Jacob's depressiveness. She is a woman of action, but she still has a sadness about her. "I'm 60 years old," she said, "and I sometimes wonder what I would have done if he'd been hearing." Michael said he didn't allow himself that fantasy. "I think somehow Jacob's been selected to be deaf and fucking figure it out, and that's his path," he said. "I've wished he could hear things, but at another level, I never think about what it would be like if Jacob wasn't deaf. I don't know if he'd have been happier. I don't think I would. He's just my son." I wondered why Jacob's sense of struggle persisted in the face of so much acceptance and love. Jacob said, 3 nights ago, I went out for drinks with the other people in a class I'm taking, and all of them are hearing, and we just wrote back and forth. But there is a point where they're all chatting, and I'm like, what's going on? I'm lucky that they're open to being with me, but I'm still left out. I have a lot of hearing acquaintances, but good friends? No. Deaf culture teaches me how to see the world, but it would make surviving the world a lot easier if I could hear. If I were going to have a Down syndrome child, I think I would abort. But what if my mom had found out I was deaf when she was pregnant and aborted me? I don't want to be racist, but walking alone at night, I see an unknown black person approaching, and I feel uncomfortable, even though I have black friends. I hate it. So it's the same when I make people uncomfortable because I'm deaf. I understand it, and I hate it. I just hate it. Having a vision can be a lonely business, and no strategy can unfold in its full glory without other people to carry the banner. What Megan first imagined at Tripod was extended and refined by those who followed her. Chris and Barb Montan's younger son, Spencer, was born deaf a decade after Jacob. I had never met a deaf person, Barb said, so I can only describe it as free-falling. Chris is president of Walt Disney Music, and his whole life has been sound. When Spencer was diagnosed, he was rocked, devastated. Chris said his mind went down blind alleys. What's going to happen to him? How can I protect him? How much money should I set aside? Barb contacted Tripod. They said they would mail me a package right away, but I couldn't get through the weekend, Barb said, so I went to the Tripod offices. Michael and Megan had to create a net. I had one swoop out underneath me. Barb went on, in the beginning, it's all sadness and woe and horror. My mother said, he'll end up in an asylum. In her generation, you were deaf and dumb, you were sent away. But I had this gorgeous blue-eyed son who just beamed at me. It didn't take long for me to say, who has the problem here? Because he was perfectly fine. The Montans decided almost immediately that they would learn to sign. Spencer would take speech therapy, but we would learn his language and culture, Barb said. I've got to go where he's going. I can't let any cognitive delay happen. Chris worried that the language gap would undermine his ability to be a good father. I was scared that Spencer wouldn't know who I was as a person at the level of his older brother who could hear my inflections. I said to Barb, we can't have Spencer feel like he grew up in a hearing household and got left out. Deaf students from Cal State Northridge came over to instruct Spencer and his family in ASL. They pulled into my driveway and began signing. Spencer, how are you? I see you have a car, Barb recalled, signing as she spoke. I don't know how he knew it was language, but he was totally attentive. Week after week after week, hello, how are you? Are you ready to work? Barb and Chris created such a strong signing environment that Spencer didn't know he had a disability until he was 4 or 5. Barb has a nearly photographic memory and turned out to be a natural at sign. Chris's years playing the piano made him extremely dexterous, and he became a fluent fingerspeller. Spencer could interpret and understand his parents' signing, as well as full-fledged ASL. When he was born, Chris said, I was working like crazy, building a company with Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner. I could have gone to work for 20 hours a day. Barb turned to me early on and said, I think you're doing an okay job as a dad, and I know you're building your career at Disney, but I need more. I need you to be more of a person, a deeper person. A less selfish person. Chris told his colleagues at work that he'd have to cut back. Niels, the Montan's elder son, has been diagnosed with both severe asthma and attention deficit disorder. I would say Niels had a harder time growing up, Barbara said. Spencer was easier. Niels is very cerebral, and Spencer is much more visceral. There's so much more kidding around, a tremendous amount of humor, play on words, play on signs. Because public education does not begin until age 5, Tripod has a privately funded Montessori preschool program for deaf and hearing children. Spencer's development in ASL was rapid. The hearing kids in the class learn nearly as fast. Most disabled kids are always on the receiving end of help, Barb said. What does that do for someone's self-esteem? But if a little hearing girl didn't know what to do in math, Spencer could help her. In the general population, she observed, you are learning to read until 4th grade, and you are reading to learn thereafter. The switching comes later on for deaf children. But once Spencer got it, did he ever take off? Barb said. In 1982, Barb and a friend started Tripod Captioned Films, the first outfit that routinely captioned films to include all the nonverbal information. Indications of music, of gunshots, of a ringing telephone or doorbell. When Spencer was 9, Lou Marino, a local youth coach, gave him a pitching lesson. Lou said, I've coached for 30 years. How come I've never seen a deaf kid? Lou and Barb set up the Silent Knights, which became a Southern California regional deaf baseball league. He has incredible hand-eye coordination, Chris said. He saw the ball better than other kids. Chris and Spencer practiced baseball together. That was the way we talked, Chris said. I would occasionally sign, but mostly we were sharing this thing. He had quiet confidence, and when he was the pitcher, the team would settle around him. The Montans did consider cochlear implants. Chris said, in 1991, I wasn't sure what way the technology was going to advance. If Spencer were newly diagnosed and 13 months old today, I probably would implant him. And I say that knowing all the great deaf people we've met, and as a strong supporter of deaf culture. It's a different question today, medically and politically. If Spencer were to get an implant as a young adult, however, he would have to do auditory training to interpret the data it would produce. He would lose a year of high school when he is so socially on track and effective in his language, Barb said. I don't think it would be worth it. Spencer was refreshingly ecumenical about language, saying, I know that my voice is useful, and I am glad to develop it. Mom and Dad went to take ASL classes so we could communicate. If they could learn ASL, I can do this too. My main language is ASL. But by practicing and practicing, I don't need tutors to help me with my English. I work on my voice, and the kids at my school and in my baseball league work on signing. We want to live in one world. Barb has been frustrated by the anti-speech sentiment in the deaf world. Spencer is fine signing with me the way I sign, with Chris the way he signs, with his deaf friends in fluent ASL. He is fully bilingual between written English and sign. At the same time, she recognizes the deep importance of deaf society. Every culture, you want critical mass, and he's got it with his deaf friends. We all need our people. Barb eventually became president of Tripod. Last night, this mom walked in whose son is 4, Barb said. She's got nothing but worries. Spencer was doing his chemistry homework, moles, fractals, and I held up the sheet and said, your son will do this. Spencer said, parents of deaf kids should know not to be afraid, not to let their kid be afraid. My parents made sure I was never afraid.
Debates still rage about oralism versus manualism, and whether sign teaching should be conducted in American Sign Language or with techniques such as total communication or simultaneous communication, in which sign and English are combined to allow teachers to sign while speaking. These methods seek to provide deaf children multiple avenues of communication. However, problems can arise when one attempts to merge unrelated grammars and syntaxes. English and ASL are different in structure. One can no more speak English while signing an ASL than one can speak English while writing Chinese. English is a sequential language, with words produced in defined order. The listener's short-term memory holds the words of a sentence, then takes meaning from their relationship. ASL is a simultaneous language in which individual signs are amalgamated into composite ones. One complex fluid movement could mean, for example, he moved from the East Coast to the West Coast. Each sign includes a hand shape, a location on or near the body where the shape is held, and a directional movement. Additionally, facial expressions serve not just to communicate emotions, but as structural components of individual signs. This compounding works well for short-term visual memory, which can hold fewer discrete images than auditory memory. If one needed to make first the sign for he, then moved, then from, and so on, the mechanical effort would become tedious and the logic would disappear. The same unintelligible jumble would result if one needed to speak several different words simultaneously. Forms of manually coded English, such as signed exact English, pigeon signed English, or conceptually accurate signed English, which go word by word through a sentence as if it were being spoken in English, are usually preferred by those deafened post-lingually, who often continue to think in spoken language. However, for children acquiring a first language, sign languages based on oral ones are cumbersome and confusing. A grammar inappropriate to the medium cannot be grasped intuitively. Gary Mole, former head of the ASL department at the National Technical Institute for the Deaf in Rochester, often corrects his children's grammar and usage in ASL. "People ask why you need to teach ASL to people who are already native signers," Mole said. "Why do you teach English to English-speaking students? So many people use the language badly. There is nonetheless great variety in ASL users' individual voices. Some move their hands and faces precisely, some extravagantly, some playfully, and some with great solemnity. ASL has evolved too. Films of people signing in the early 20th century show a different and less nuanced use of language." Benjamin Behan, a professor of ASL and deaf studies at Gallaudet, is deaf of deaf. He has described poignantly how he grew up thinking that his mother, who had an oral education, was the smart one, while his father, who had grown up manual, was a bit dim-witted. When he returned home after studying ASL at college, he realized that his father signed beautiful ASL with grammatical features and structure, while his mother's ASL was substantially less fluent. ASL grammar is a locus of both precision and pride. Many sign translators miss half of what is said, mistranslate, and lose the thread of the conversation. I found this myself as I worked with translators, many of whom had been drawn to ASL more for its similarity to theater than for its status as language. The grammar is so conceptually different from oral grammar that it eludes even many people who study it closely. Fluent translators can find it difficult to rearrange ASL structures into English ones, and vice versa, and lose the patterns of meaning. Accent and intonation tend to disappear entirely. Hearing people often mistakenly assume that there is one universal sign language, but there are many. Due to the work of Laurent Clerc, ASL is closely related to French Sign Language. In contrast, ASL is very different from British Sign Language, which many ASL users contend is less sophisticated. "We don't have so many puns. We don't play with the words the way you do," conceded Clark Denmark, a lecturer in deaf studies at the University of Central Lancashire. "It's a more literal language, but it has strengths of its own." Some are concerned that the spread of ASL as a kind of lingua franca for deaf people will lead to the loss of other sign languages. No one has been able to assess how many sign languages there are, but we know of at least 7 in Thailand and Vietnam. Iran has both Tea House Sign Language and Persian Sign Language. Canadians use both ASL and Quebecois Sign Language. The issue of deafness in most societies is one of linguistic exclusion, and I was interested in the idea of a context in which sign was universal. In the small village of Bengkala, in northern Bali, a congenital form of deafness has persisted for some 250 years, and at any time affects about 2% of the population. Everyone in Bengkala has grown up with deaf people, and everyone knows the unique sign language used in the village, so the gap between the experience of hearing and deaf people is narrower than perhaps anywhere else in the world. Bengkala is also known as Desa Kolok, or Deaf Village. When I visited in 2008, 46 of the village's approximately 2,000 residents were deaf. Because this deafness springs from a recessive gene, no one knows when it will emerge in his family. I met hearing parents with deaf children, deaf parents with hearing children, deaf families with deaf parents and children, deaf or hearing parents with a mix of deaf and hearing children. It's a poor village, and the general education level is low, but it has been even lower among the deaf. Kanta, a hearing teacher in the village, introduced a program in 2007 to educate the deaf of Bengkala in their own sign language, Karakolok. The first deaf class had pupils from ages 7 to 14, because none had had any formal education previously. The life of villages in northern Bali is based on a clan system. The deaf can both participate in and transcend their clans. For their children's birthdays, for example, they invite their own clan, as well as the Deaf Alliance in the village, while hearing people would not invite anyone outside their clan. The deaf have certain traditional jobs. They bury the dead and service the police, though there is almost no crime. They repair pipes in the often troubled water system. Most are also farmers, planting cassava, taro, and elephant grass, which is used to feed cows. Bengkala has a traditional chief who presides over religious ceremonies, an administrative chief chosen by the central Balinese government to oversee government functions, and a deaf chief, traditionally the oldest deaf person. I arrived in Bengkala with the Balinese linguist I. Gede Marsaja, born in a neighboring village, who has studied Karakolok in depth. We climbed down into a canyon where a river rushed under a 200-foot sheer rock wall. Several deaf villagers were waiting for us by the water, where they keep a farm with a grove of rambutan trees, some elephant grass, and a variety of extremely hot peppers. Over the next half hour, the rest of Bengkala's deaf arrived. I sat on a red blanket at one end of a large tarp, and the deaf arranged themselves around the edge. People were signing to me, confident that I could understand. Gede translated, and Kanta, the schoolmaster, provided further assistance. But to my surprise, I could follow fairly well, and quickly learned a few signs. Whenever I used them, the entire group would break out in smiles. They seemed to have multiple levels and kinds of signing, because when they were signing to me, they were like a bunch of mimes, and I could follow their narratives clearly. But when they were signing to one another, I couldn't figure out what they were saying at all. And when they were signing to Gede, they were somewhere in between. The Karakolok sign for sad is the index and middle fingers at the inside corners of the eyes and then drawn down like tears. The sign for father is an index finger laid across the upper lip to suggest a mustache. The sign for mother is an upward-facing open hand at chest level supporting an imaginary breast. The sign for deaf is the index finger inserted into the ear and rotated. The sign for hearing is the whole hand held closed beside the ear and then opened while it is moved away from the head, sort of like an explosion coming out of the skull. In Karakalok, positive words usually involve pointing upward, while negative ones involve pointing downward. One villager who had traveled told the others that the raised third finger is a bad word in the West. So they flipped the sign and now use a third finger pointing down to indicate horrendous. The vocabulary is constantly evolving, while the grammar is fairly static. Second-generation language is always more sophisticated and ordered than first-generation, and a language of many generations acquires a clear architecture. Spoken language among farmers in northern Bali does not feature a large vocabulary, and neither does Karakalok. About 1,000 signs have been definitely identified by scholars, but the deaf of Bankala clearly know more signs than this and can combine existing signs to communicate new meanings. For educated Westerners, intimacy requires the mutual knowledge achieved as language unlocks the secrets of two minds. But for some people, the self is expressed largely in the preparation of food and the ministrations of erotic passion and shared labor. And for such people, the meaning embedded in words is a garnish to love rather than its conduit. I had come into a society in which, for the hearing and the deaf, language was not the primary medium through which to negotiate the world. When we finished lunch, 14 men put on sarongs, and 2 women donned fancy, lacy, nylon blouses. Like most deaf people, they could feel the vibrations of the drum, and their dance included movements that seemed to flow from their mimetic language. They offered to show us the martial arts they use as the village security agents. I was interested in the way they mixed signing and the deployment of their hands and feet as weapons. One young man, Suryasa, resisted joining in the demonstration until he was shamed into it by his mother, and the whole time he was showing us his abilities, he was also signing repeatedly, "Look at me!" It was fierce, but playful. The women dancers came around and gave everyone a sprite, and then the men proposed a dip in the river, so we went skinny dipping. The rock wall rose steep above us, and long vines hung down, and the deaf men swung on them. I did somersaults in the water, others did headstands, and we set bait to fish for eels. Sometimes one would swim underwater until he was right beside me, then shoot up out of the current. They continued to sign to me, and there was something exuberant, even joyful, about the communication. It seemed possible to contemplate this as an idyll, despite the poverty and disability of the villagers. The next day, Kanta translated from Karakalok into Balinese, occasionally addressing me in his limited English. Gede translated Kanta's Balinese into English, occasionally signing in his limited Karakalok, and the deaf Bankala villagers addressed me directly in animated sign. Communication in this linguistic jumble was established through sheer force of collective will. There were limits to what one could ask because many grammatical structures couldn't be translated. For example, there is no conditional tense in Karakalok. The language also has no categorical words, such as animals, or the abstract notion of name, only specific ones, such as cow, or someone's actual name. There was no way to ask why questions. I met the family of Sancha, the deaf son of hearing parents, and his wife, Seneng Sukesti, the deaf daughter of deaf parents. The two had been childhood friends. Sancha was somewhat slow, whereas Seneng Sukesti was vibrant, lively, and intelligent. Sukesti chose to marry a deaf man whose hearing parents owned enough land for them to work. Sukesti said, "I've never been jealous of hearing people. Life is no easier for them. If we work hard, we will get money too. I take care of the cows, sow the seeds, boil the cassava. I can communicate with everyone. If I lived in another village, I might want to be hearing, but I like it here. Three of Sancha and Sukesti's four children were deaf. When their son Suvaraputra was 9 months old, hearing friends of his parents said he was hearing. At 11 months, he began to sign and is now fluent, though he feels more fluent in speech. As a young adult, Suvaraputra often translates for his parents. He'd never want to give up his hearing. "I have two, where most people have one," he said. But he maintained he could have been equally happy being deaf. Nonetheless, he said, "I think my parents like having one hearing child. Not that they love me more, but I drink less and don't ask for money all the time. Yet I'd have less tension with them if I were like them." Sukesti said that Suvaraputra sang even better than his deaf siblings, because spoken language had made him more comfortable expressing complex ideas. Another couple, Sandi and his wife Kebyar, lived with their two deaf sons, Ngarda and Sudharma. Ngarda's hearing wife, Molsami, came from another village, and Ngarda was glad to have four hearing children. "We already have many deaf people here," he said emphatically. "If all of us are deaf, it's not good." Sudharma, on the other hand, insisted that he never would have married a hearing woman. "Deaf people should stick together," he said. "I want to live among deaf people, and I wanted deaf children." In this community, people talk about deafness and hearing much as people in more familiar societies might talk about height or race, as personal characteristics with advantages and disadvantages. They did not discount the significance of deafness nor underplay its role in their lives. They did not forget whether they were deaf or hearing, and did not expect others to forget it either. The Deaf Alliance in Bengkala is extremely free in every sense except geography. Their freedom is predicated on a linguistic fluency shared only in their village. I had gone there to investigate the social constructionist model of disability, and I found that where deafness does not impair communication, it is not much of a handicap. It is not possible to recreate in America a world of acceptance like that which greets deaf children in Bengkala. But parents such as April and Raj Chauhan succeed in building community to an extraordinary degree, negotiating the diplomatic challenges of ingratiating themselves in a culture that regards them with suspicion. From a privileged African-American background, April grew up among artists. Expression comes readily to her. She radiates determination, purpose, and a winning toughness. Raj is of mixed Indian and Pakistani background, handsome and smooth. You can imagine that he will still seem this young when he is old. He works in internet sales, and he speaks with confident ease. Many of the parents of deaf children whom I met seemed anxious, but the Chauhans were relaxed. Their innate sense of hospitality had disarmed a deaf world that other parents had found forbidding. When Zara Chauhan was born in 2000, April and Raj were young and struggling and had little experience of babies. The L.A. hospital where their daughter was born didn't perform hearing screenings on newborns. When Zara was 3 months old, a fire in the building where the Chauhans lived set off shrieking alarms. April ran to the baby's room and found her sound asleep. The pediatrician told April that newborns can sleep through anything. As Zara reached the age at which other children babbled, she wasn't babbling. The only sound she made were little grunts. April and Raj would try to test her, clapping when she was turned away. Sometimes she would respond, and sometimes she wouldn't, April said. Looking back, she most likely saw us out of the corner of her eye. At 20 months, Zara had produced some version of Mama and Dada, but no other words. The pediatrician said that many children don't talk until they are 3. When April took Zara in for her 2-year checkup, their regular pediatrician was out sick, and the substitute immediately said that they should have a hearing test. Those 2 years that we lost would have been time for us to educate ourselves, for Zara to have exposure to language, and for getting her hearing aids, April said with regret. When the news came, April was saddened by it. But Raj was not. He explained, April wanted to go through the stages of emptiness, fear, sadness, pain, uncertainty, and I wasn't there. This was just something to add to the list of stuff we had to deal with. Early intervention in Los Angeles County was available for children from birth to 3, so Zara would be eligible for only a year of free services. I had to educate myself as quickly as possible to know what we wanted, April said. The audiologist said Zara had some meaningful residual hearing in low registers, so a cochlear implant was not an obvious choice. April said, I want her to be confident in who she is. If she decides one day that she wants an implant, that's great. But I couldn't make that decision for her. Zara acquired transpositional aids that drop all the higher-pitched sounds down into the lower register where her residual hearing lies. But April knew that hearing aids weren't going to make Zara hear. I had lost 2 years of communicating with my daughter, she said. We started off with the repetition of apple, apple. We were told it takes 1,000 times for a deaf child before they get it. So it was all day long drilling things. Water. Water. Book. Book. Shoe. Shoe. She might repeat something occasionally, but it didn't take me long to think, this is not good enough. So within a month, we decided to sign. I could literally feel that a different part of my brain was working because I would get splitting headaches. Raj, who already spoke English, Hindi, a little Spanish, and Italian, said, I always say it's like a Google search. Malibu wants door juice, all at once. At first, April and Raj were learning faster than Zara, which allowed them to teach her. But Zara soon pulled ahead. Even though ASL is Zara's primary language, April and Raj wanted her to have as much fluency in speech as she could reasonably achieve, and they arranged for her to have speech therapy. When she was still making no progress at 5, they found a new therapist, who asked April what Zara liked to eat. April said she ate 4 foods, cereal, peanut butter, bread, and oatmeal. The therapist observed that those were all soft foods. She has an oral motor problem as well, she explained. Her tongue doesn't have the strength to control sounds. April and Raj started doing tongue exercises with Zara. The process was much like that for building up any other muscle, but the fibrous tongue is actually the strongest muscle per inch in the body. If it were the size of a biceps, you could pick up a car with it. The exercises often used a tongue depressor, pushing the tongue around, building it up. Zara was told to chew gum as much as possible. The change was rapid. Zara had always refused to eat meat, but once she had strengthened her tongue and got used to chewing, she was all for it. Her ability to produce sounds increased dramatically. All this progress has come with considerable effort. April has been a stay-at-home mom so that she can focus more fully on Zara. Even to tell us, I need to go to the bathroom, means she has to stop, turn around, get our attention, April said. It's a full-body language. We're always giving her access to sound. If there's a bird, Raj says, did you hear the bird? Or an airplane? Or a helicopter? Some days she can identify instruments and music, a horn, flute, piano, with the hearing aids. She hears more than she's technically supposed to. Every deaf person I met in California seemed to have been to parties at April and Raj's place. We get invited to a lot of deaf events and vice versa, April said. I heard about a deaf man who worked for NASA, a great scientist, and I invited him over. People in the deaf community are almost always willing to meet with hearing parents, but you have to reach out to them. They're not going to come to you. I had met so many parents who were intimidated by deaf adults, and I wondered what had given April and Raj the courage to break into that world. Raj explained that he had grown up in a small town in Georgia where the KKK marched on the weekends, and black and white kids sat at different tables in the lunchroom. Deaf culture and black culture and Indian, you get flexible, he said. Raised by a mother with a strong sense of African-American history, April was an activist as a kid. I had gay friends, so we set up gay organizations at school. When I had a deaf child, it was like, here's another one for me to be involved in. She held out her hands. My whole life prepared me to access the deaf world, and I'm preparing her to be comfortable in all the non-deaf worlds. We have wide citizenships in this family. In 1790, Alessandro Volta discovered that electrical stimulation to the auditory system could mimic sound. He put metal rods in his ears and connected them to a circuit, giving himself a nasty shock and hearing what sounded like boiling paste. In 1957, André Journeau and Charles Arias used an electric wire to stimulate the auditory nerve of a patient undergoing brain surgery, who heard a sound like crickets. During the 1960s, researchers began placing multiple electrodes in the cochlea. These devices, instead of amplifying sound as a hearing aid would, actually stimulated directly the brain areas where sound would be received by hearing people. This technology was gradually refined, and in 1984 the FDA approved a device for use by late deafened adults. Because it transmitted on a single channel, it gave information on the loudness and timing of sounds, but did not convey the content of those sounds. By 1990, a multi-channel device, which stimulated different areas of the cochlea, was on the market. Today, some devices operate on 24 channels. A microphone picks up sounds from the environment and conveys them to a speech processor, which selects and arranges those sounds. A transmitter and receiver stimulator receive this information as signals and convert them into electric impulses. Passing through a device placed within the skull, an array of electrodes sends those impulses to different regions of the auditory nerve, bypassing damaged portions of the inner ear. The cochlear implant does not allow you to hear, but rather allows you to do something that resembles hearing. It gives you a process that is, sometimes, rich in information, and, usually, devoid of music. Implanted early, it can provide a basis for the development of oral language. It makes the hearing world easier. Is it sound? One might as well ask whether a tree falling in an empty forest makes noise. Some 219,000 people worldwide, at least 50,000 of them children, had received implants as of the end of 2010. Up to 40% of American children diagnosed under 3 receive an implant, up from 25% just 5 years ago. Some 85% of the children who receive them are born to white families with higher than average income and education levels. After the device has been surgically implanted, an audiologist works on mapping it, making a series of adjustments to ensure that it is tuned to the brain of the recipient. The chief executive of the Cochlear Corporation, the leading manufacturer of implants, told Business Week in 2005 that usage represented only 10% of the potential market. The implant is sold in more than 70 countries. Some implant opponents complain of the limitations and dangers of the implant itself. According to the FDA, one child in four who receives it experiences adverse reactions and complications, most of which resolve on their own. Some require further surgery. Some people have suffered disfiguring facial paralysis and the implant interferes with diagnostic tests such as magnetic resonance imaging. A wire coming out of your neck can make you look like an extra from Star Trek, though it is possible to grow hair so the wire is generally hidden. Much of the cant about the danger of implants is alarmist. Some propaganda about their transformative power is embellished. A late deafened adult who regained his hearing with an implant quipped that they made everyone sound like R2-D2 with severe laryngitis. Their approximation of sound often allows people who are already functional in spoken language to make sense of much of what they hear. However, people who have always been deaf and who receive the implants as adults often find them ineffective or just irritating. Unaccustomed to interpreting auditory information, the latter group might find it difficult to do so even if they were given perfect hearing. The brain develops around input, and a brain that has gone through development without sound is not organized to process it. But the extent of any individual's brain plasticity is hard to predict. In a recent interview, a deaf woman who had received what she called the bionic ear in early adulthood described having vertigo at first, and then feeling as though golf balls were bouncing around in her head. "I felt like it was a huge mistake for about 5 hours," she said. The next morning, she went out for a walk. "I stepped on a twig and it crackled. Leaves rustled. It blew me away." Deafness, which often used to go undetected until age 3, is now regularly diagnosed within hours of birth, and almost always before 3 months. Screenings of newborns are now supported by the federal government. The NAD originally championed these screenings on grounds that deaf infants could get exposure to sign as early as possible. Now, those infants often get cochlear implants instead. "That's hugely painful," said the activist Patrick Boudreau, who opposes the implants. "Genetic counselors and implant specialists are the first responders, not deaf people." Though the device is approved only for children over the age of 2, children under a year old have been implanted. Hearing children learn phonemes throughout the first year of life, and their neuroplasticity begins to decrease even at a year. A recent Australian study showed improved results for people implanted at 7 or 8 months, though the advantages to implanting before age 1 may not be worth the risks associated with anesthesia in babies. In another study, almost half of children implanted at 2 developed spoken language equivalent to that of hearing children their age. Among those implanted at 4, only 16% did so. For children who become deaf later, from measles, meningitis, or a developmental genetic condition, efficacy is linked to how soon the devices are implanted. Without sound, the neural architecture of the auditory cortex is permanently compromised. These statistics are muddied, however, by their newness. Will someone implanted at 7 months have a linguistic advantage when he's 12 years old? No one has seen how these early cases turn out across the lifespan because they haven't been done for long enough. Further, the devices being implanted now are different from the ones used even a decade ago. This means that all decisions about how early to implant children are based on speculation rather than experience. One unintended consequence of the rise in cochlear implants is that they can make the parents of a deaf child careless about language acquisition, which the FDA unfortunately failed to establish as one of the criteria for implant success in pediatric populations. Almost all children who have the implants show useful perception of sound, but with older implants, the sound was often too garbled to interpret as language. That problem is reduced but not eliminated with the newer implants. One study showed that almost half of implanted children had greater than 70% open speech discrimination, comprehending sound without visual clues. 2/3 had greater than 50%, and 9 out of 10 had greater than 40%. In a Gallaudet survey, nearly half of parents of implanted children believe their children could hear and understand most words, while only 1 in 5 said their children could hear and understand few words.